A Christmas market, sparkling decorations, then carol singers in ye olde rose and crown. Lucy Worsley, Chief Curator, Historic Royal Palaces.
All around the world, people are singing Christmas carols in cities, in schools, in pubs, and even sometimes still in pretty parish churches on village greens.
A mulled wine stall, pub customers applauding, then fairy lights twinkling on a Christmas tree.
It's the one time of year when even people who can't sing think that it's probably okay if they join in. Carols are as big a part of Christmas as mince pies or the tree.
My favourite Christmas carol is either Jingle Bells, because it's just ridiculously fun, or We Wish You a Merry Christmas.
A Little Town of Bethlehem.
Unquestionably, O Come All You Faithful.
Ding Dong Merrily on High.
Silent Night.
While shepherds watched and hark the herald angels sing, because they're both real belters.
There are hundreds of Christmas carols, and they're a vital part of a traditional Christmas. We take them for granted.
Oh, these are the Leaping Lords, aren't they?
Yes.
That's hilarious.
But each one of them has a really fascinating history.
Joan!
Ooh la la!
Carols can take us on a surprising journey into the past, to ancient midwinter revels, to religious conflict.
It was an oppressed minority. It's an extraordinarily dangerous time to live.
And to a devastating world war.
We heard them singing Silent Night, Still Enough, Silent Night. I shall never forget it. It's one of the highlights of my life.
The first Christmas songs evolved from a pagan winter festival.
Quite simply, Christianity takes it over gloriously and makes it Christmas.
Then they got banned by the church.
Basically, everything that you could enjoy doing was bad for your soul. Going to the pub, having fun, Christmas, all of these things were out.
But the carol made a magnificent comeback. I'm going to find out where the best-loved Christmas carols come from and what gives them their magic.
Singers in a pub high-five and clap their hands. Lucy Worsley's Christmas Carol Odyssey. Here We Come A-Wassailing. A procession of musicians and flaming torch carriers in feathered hats and colourful costumes.
Our story begins with an Anglo-Saxon tradition that predates Christmas itself. The wassail, a fertility ritual rooted in pagan magic.
Lucy joins a gathering beside a tree.
Hello. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to our wassail.
Thank you, thank you.
We're going to bless the apple tree as part of our wassail.
Hello, tree.
We are going to sprinkle some cider on the roots.
Yes.
We're going to put some toast on the branches. We're going to sing our wassail song just to make sure that there'll be a good crop of apples next year.
Brilliant.
Cider from this loving cup, too much for mortal man to sup. About thy roots the goodness spread and help you in the year ahead. If we take some of the bread.
Here you go, Mr. Tree.
Here we come a-wassailing all on the winter tide, and here we come to bring good cheer and cast all care aside. Love and joy come to you, and to you your wassail true, and God bless you and send you a happy new year, and God send you a happy new year.
And the last thing we must do is scare off the evil spirits from around the orchard. One, two, three, yay!
Leafless trees against a pale sky, then ducks on calm water.
The orchard wassail was part of a much bigger midwinter blowout, and it had a surprising influence on the timing of today's Christmas celebrations.
Why is it that there always seems to have been a special festival in the middle of winter?
It's just the perfect time for a party. Number one, there's no work, no fighting, no trading, no farming. Number two, it's the dreariest time of year, so you really need cheering up. put the two together, and it's the festive season.
And what happens to the pagan midwinter festival when Christianity comes along?
Quite simply, Christianity takes it over gloriously and makes it Christmas. If you read the Gospels, there's nothing in them to say exactly at what time of the year Christ was born. Although if it's when shepherds watch their flocks by night, it's most likely to be May or September. But in the 4th century, when Christianity is becoming dominant, Christmas settles at midwinter with this glorious symbolism of the rebirth of the sun, S-U-N, becoming that of the rebirth of the sun, S-O-N. And it's just a wonderful time for a festival.
And do you wassail yourself? Have you got an apple tree?
I have an apple tree and I wassail it myself every year. I never bore any fruit till I started wassailing, had a bumper crop ever since.
It's such a lovely idea, isn't it?
And it's fun.
To the pub, everyone!
Over the years, wassailers started visiting homes and ale houses.
Here we come a-wassailing along the winter tide.
Pub customers peer through windows as the wassailers sing outside.
Love and joy come to you.
In return for a blessing, they expected some food or money or a drink.
They knock on the pub door.
Is this what you were after?
Yeah!
Lucy's brought them a drink. She tries it.
And that's the origin of door-to-door carol singing.
The wassailers dance, beating sticks together. Mistletoe, mulled wine and mince pies.
Christmas continued to evolve into a religious feast with loads of merrymaking and excess. By Tudor times, Father Christmas had joined the party. And Christmas carols have always been at the heart of the celebrations.
Natural Voices Choir.
When they are both full grown, of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears the crown.
It's almost something you're just born with. You've heard it since you're in the belly.
We all know them without knowing how we know them or why we know them.
The children know it, the adults know it, the older people know it, and it's something that brings us together immediately.
There's a blossom as white as lily flower, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ to be our sweet saviour. Oh, the rising of the sun and the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, the singing of the choir.
Ding dong merrily on high. A row of houses with shuttered windows.
After the Norman conquest in 1066, the Anglo-Saxon word wassail gradually gave way to the French word carol, meaning song and dance. A surprising number of Christmas carols get their words and music from different origins. This familiar melody started life as a 16th century French Renaissance dance.
Dancers in 16th century costume.
That was beautiful. Now that to me is Ding Dong Merrily on High, the Christmas carol.
No.
No?
It's a branle de l'official.
The branle l'official.
Branle de l'official.
Le branle official. She's laughing at me. I can't say the letter R. Branle. Yeah, OK, it's a dance.
If you want, I can show you.
Oh, yes.
It's with two steps to the left. One. Two. And two little to the right.
Two little to the right.
And for the second time, we have six steps to the left with a little jump.
Six steps to the left with a little jump.
A musician plays as Lucy joins the dancers. They step to the left holding hands. Then the dance ends with Lucy being lifted off her feet.
Jump!
Ooh la la!
A stone statue.
The man behind this little jig was Jean Tabareau, the canon at the cathedral in Langres. France was still Roman Catholic, but in the 15th century, Christianity had begun to splinter. The Protestants were on the march.
Tabareau hated the chilly Protestant wind that was blowing through Europe. That's because he was a devout Roman Catholic, but it's also because Protestant reformers were starting to clamp down on one of the other things that he loved, and that was dancing.
Tabareau and his dance might easily have been forgotten, but he found an ingenious way to record it for posterity.
Jean Tabareau invented a new way of notating dance with words, with figures, and also with new system of notation of the movements.
How does this notation work?
He puts the music on the vertical.
Yes.
And on each note, you have the step you are to do on this precise note.
Pied gauche largi, left foot largi.
Largi.
What does that mean?
It's better to show you than to explain. In fact, here it is.
Oh, the little man's doing the largi.
Exactly.
He's standing like this.
Exactly. It is the ancestor of the second position in classical ballet, in fact.
So we have this great lover of dance. What does Monsieur Tabareau make of Protestant reformers?
He says that one of the reasons why we should like dance is especially because the reformers, the Protestant, don't like it.
Protestantism, boom. So we have this dancing tune that turned into our Christmas carol in Protestant England. What do you think that Monsieur Tabareau would have made of that?
He was a festive man. I think he would have been happy, but in the same time, it's for the Protestants. So he would be surprised, I think.
The choir of Her Majesty's Chapel Royal, Hampton Court Palace.
The ding-dong melody stayed in France for another 300 years. But in 1924, a prolific hymn writer called George Woodward came across Tabareau's tune. He finally paired it up with the words we sing today.
From the choristers in their red robes and ruffs to Lucy being lifted at the end of the dance.
Très élégant.
Thank you.
Sunlight catching a holly tree, then an imposing church under a leaden sky.
In 1534, the Protestant Reformation came to Britain. Henry VIII embraced the singing of carols as part of the merry Tudor Christmas. But when Henry died in 1547, the carol was going to be in for a bumpy ride.
The new king was Edward VI. He was a very hot Protestant against the old Catholic Church. At the age of 12, he wrote a treatise in which he described the Pope as the Antichrist. He was pretty much down on all forms of jollity. He once told off his elder sister Mary for enjoying foreign dances and other merriments that he thought were inappropriate for a Christian princess. Imagine, then, what he would have made of Christmas carols.
While shepherds watch their flocks by night or seated on the ground, the angel of the Lord came down and glory shone around.
Edward was a bit of a killjoy, but one of his tutors, Christopher Tye, composed a piece of music that would become one of our favourite carols.
Of great joy I bring to you and all mankind.
Tye was the choirmaster here at Ely Cathedral. Andrew Gant has studied the evolution of church music during the Reformation.
What sort of music appealed to Edward VI and his very Protestant buddies?
It's all about the word. That's the key thing. Musically, what that means is simplicity. The old Catholic music was complicated and magnificent to the extent that, frankly, you can't really hear the words, even if you could understand the Latin. What they needed was simple, straightforward tunes with words in English which you could hear. Christopher Tye published his version of the Acts of the Apostles. This is very much in the tradition of Protestant music making. This is his setting of chapter 8. Scattered they were both far and nigh, and through the regions crept, of Jewry and of Samurai, the 12 only except.
It's the tune that we know. He wrote it.
Yes, indeed, yes.
But Tye's tune wasn't a Christmas carol yet. The words came later, thanks to an even more extreme group of Protestants, the Puritans.
Musicians in an illustration.
The Puritans took aim at Christmas. They saw it as a sort of vestige of the depraved old Catholic Church. This is an ordinance passed by Parliament in 1644, explaining what's to happen at Christmas. They want to see more solemn humiliation, more remembrance of our sins. It was to be a day of fasting. And they definitely wanted to see less liberty given to carnal and sensual delights. So never mind the carol singing. They practically abolished Christmas itself.
Just about the only thing that the Puritans allowed to be sung in church were the Psalms, verses from the Bible. But one new song was about to change that.
Towards the very end of the 17th century, a new version of the Book of Psalms is produced, which contained in it this song here, which they call Song of the Angels at the Nativity of Our Blessed Saviour. It's a paraphrase of a passage of Scripture, which means you're allowed to sing it in church because it's from the Bible. And look what it says here. To St. James's tune or any other tune of 8 and 6 syllables. In other words, you can sing it to any tune you like. And the poem goes, while shepherds watched their flocks by night, all seated on the ground, the angel of the Lord came down and glory shone around. And so it goes on, and there it is for the first time in print.
While shepherds watched their flocks by night.
So Christopher Tye's 16th century tune combined with a 17th century song, it's given us the carol that we know.
That's right.
And glory shone around.
So a very Protestant song, While Shepherds Watched, was the first Christmas carol to be approved by the Church of England. And Christopher Tye's mid-Tudor melody is still the one most of us sing today.
Joy I bring to you and all mankind.
The 12 Days of Christmas. Baubles on a tree and the moon in the night sky.
On the 12th day of Christmas my true love gave to me 12 drummers drumming, 11 pipers piping, 10 lords a-leaping, 9 ladies dancing, 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 gold rings, 4 calling birds.
This jolly carol captures the fun and games we now associate with Christmas. There's an early record of the words here in the British Library.
What have we got here, Maddie?
This is a pocket-sized children's book called Mirth Without Mischief.
Isn't it cute?
And it contains the first reference to the 12 Days of Christmas.
So is that a song or a poem or what at this stage in its life?
I think it would have been what is referred to as a forfeit game. And so it would have been sung, well, chanted by children, and each person repeats the words said by the previous person but adds a line to it. It gets longer and longer and harder to remember.
And if you lose, you forfeit.
You do pay a forfeit. I think things like tickling was the forfeit for these kids.
And it's got little pictures in it as well.
Yes, it has. It's got a woodcut for every rhyme.
Oh, these are the Leaping Lords,
aren't
they? They're
the Leaping Lords, yes.
That's hilarious.
It's a lovely woodcut of the Leaping Lords.
They're limping over some sort of hurdles.
Yes, in a race. They are.
So these are the things of the 12 days of Christmas that we know.
Yes, there are some differences, though. For instance, in this version from the 18th century, it's four collie birds instead of four calling birds.
What's a collie bird?
Well, collie was a regional English expression for coal black, and we think that it came from the north of England. And so perhaps they're saying four blackbirds.
That's
interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. So blackbirds, coal-coloured birds, become collie birds, which become calling birds to us.
Precisely, yes.
I think it might be the nicest little book I've ever seen.
It's certainly lovely.
Christmas, people often say today, is all about the children. And this little book shows that this idea was emerging in the 18th century. But the origin of its tune is a mystery.
As with lots of carols, we don't know where the tune came from. It was probably handed down through generations. But we do know about one man who gave the tune a bit of a polish and who added a flourish all of his own.
Frederick Austin was born in the East End of London in 1872. He sang for Elgar. He performed in Wagner's operas at Covent Garden. But that's not his greatest legacy.
In 1909, Frederick published an arrangement of the tune of the 12 Days of Christmas. And because he was an opera singer, it seems that he added in a bit specially to show off his voice. I imagine him belting this out at the Christmas party. Frederick's special bit, where everybody has to become a diva, is this bit.
Five gold
rings.
Four calling birds, three French hens, two turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Sunlight through treetops, then a snowy churchyard.
In the 18th century, Britain continued to be a religious battleground. And the Christmas carol was caught up in a story of political intrigue and treason. British Catholics were being persecuted and forced to worship in secret. Some sought sanctuary across the Channel.
One of them was the son of a cloth merchant from Leeds, and his name was John Francis Wade. As a young man, he went to Douai in northern France. At Douai, there was a special theological college for English Catholics. It was even called the English College.
John Francis Wade produced hand-drawn copies of sacred texts and music that were smuggled into England by aristocratic Catholics. But in 1789, the French Revolution forced the English College to leave France.
And this is where they ended up. St. Edmund's Catholic School is a direct descendant of the English College at Douai. And when the English Catholics came back, they smuggled into the country with them all their treasures, their sacred relics, their books, their music. And in this school's archives, there's still a song containing a seditious secret.
Catholic supporters of the exiled King James, that's the Jacobites, aimed to bring down the Protestant King George. Among them was Wade. He wanted James's grandson, Bonnie Prince Charlie, to take the throne back for the Stuarts.
Bennett, what's this tasty thing we're looking at here?
This is one of the first manuscripts to include Adeste Fidelis, O Come All Ye Faithful, and it's written by John Francis Wade.
So today this would be sung in the Church of England, nothing unusual about that. But you believe it's got layers of secret Catholic meaning, don't you?
I do. This is a book that Wade published in 1773. This is the Evening Office of the Church in Latin and English. One thing that we notice here is this very peculiar cryptogram. We read it from the top into the middle on each word. It reads, Quos anguis Christi diro cum vulnere stravit, hos sanguis Christi miro tum munere lavit, which roughly means those bitten with a sad, dread wound by the snake will be washed afterward with a wonderful gift by Christ. And those words directly correspond to symbols used in Jacobite poetry. So the snake, for example, is obviously King George. And Christ, of course, is Bonnie Prince Charlie. The wonderful gift is the recovery of the Stuart throne. Yeah.
So if you and I were Jacobites, we might say, we hate the snake, and we would know what we meant.
That's it. And we know that because, of course, we have a Jacobite picture here. This is an absolutely exquisite portrait of Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Oh, and it says C-R, like Charles is king.
Precisely.
So now we know that about Wade. He's clearly using secret Jacobite images in his other book. What does that tell us about Adeste Fideles?
In and of itself, it reads as an ordinary Christmas carol. When read against Wade's other work, it takes on a completely different hue. Bethlehem is England, the faithful are Jacobites. And Regem Angelorum is...
That's the King of the Angels.
King of the Angels is a very ancient pun, which in fact is King of the English, the Angles. And of course, any Jacobite would understand this as a reference to Bonnie Prince Charlie.
So according to Catholics, it means the King of the English has been born, Bonnie Prince Charlie has been born.
This piece is a hymn to Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Come and adore him.
Lucy listens from the choir stalls.
O Come All Ye Faithful was originally sung only by Catholics, but its cryptic message was so well hidden that non-Catholics started singing it as well.
Carol singers in a pub. Professor Bennett Zonn, Durham University.
It was disseminated very widely because it was just a fantastic tune.
So the great subversive finally went mainstream.
Yeah, you might say that. His own authorship of the Christmas carol was lost, and its original meaning was lost. And to some extent, really hasn't been fully recovered.
Till now.
Until now.
A tree being decorated.
In the 18th century, the Christmas decorations came out again. Everyone was queuing up to kiss under the mistletoe. And the Church of England was finally persuaded to open its doors to all Christmas carols by this cheery tune.
Hark the Herald Angels Sing. The Kingdom Choir.
On the face of it, Christmas is the most traditional thing in the world. But traditions are slippery things, and Christmas has actually been changing its shape constantly as the centuries go past. So there's nothing new about reversioning or freshening up a Christmas carol. In fact, in the original version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing, there weren't even any angels there to hearken to.
In a packed pub, a man with a child on his shoulders joins in the singing.
Its author was Charles Wesley, one of the great hymn writers. He wrote the words of this much-loved carol, but you wouldn't have recognised them back then.
This is what Wesley wrote in his Hymns and Sacred Poems of 1739, a hymn for Christmas Day. Hark, how all the welkin rings. And it sounds like this.
Hark, how all the welkin rings.
Hallelujah.
Glory to the King of Kings. Alleluia.
So how do we go from that to the version of the carol that we'd all recognise today?
To find out, we have to go back to 1727, when Charles Wesley and his brother John formed a new religious group at their university called the Holy Club. They later became known as the Methodists.
Now, these Methodists were nonconformists. They thought that the Church of England should be reformed. And one of the big differences between them and it was music. The Church of England was still a bit uptight about what could or couldn't be sung, but the Methodists embraced the power of communal singing.
From the pub to a portrait of Charles Wesley.
Wesley's friend George Whitfield was another leading Methodist. At this church in North London, he spread their message through word and song. And Wesley's hymn was in his repertoire.
George Whitfield would go on to do something rather daring to his friend's words. 20 years after Wesley wrote them, Whitfield thought, hang on, we can do better than this. This word, welkin, it's an old word for the sky, the heavens. But Whitfield thought that the song ought to begin with the Methodists' favourite activity of singing. So he changed Hark How All the Welkin Rings to Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Hark the Herald Angels Sing, glory to the
The new version of the words is the one that stuck. But once again, the tune came later. 100 years later, when the composer Felix Mendelssohn met an English choir boy, William Cummings.
Alexandra, can you tell me the story of William Cummings?
We know he came to London as a child with his parents, and he was obviously very musically talented from an early age. He was a chorister at St Paul's Cathedral. So the next important chapter is 1847. He's just 15 years old, and he sings in a historic performance of Elijah. This was the first ever London performance of Mendelssohn's great oratorio. And he was so enthusiastic, apparently, that Mendelssohn, who was conducting, was really struck by this young man and actually gave him his business card before he left. It was quite a formative moment for the young man, and he seems to have actively pursued every opportunity to get a new score by Mendelssohn whenever they were published.
Cummings later became the organist here at Waltham Abbey. One day, while playing through a Mendelssohn piece called Festgesang, he had a brainwave.
There's an article in the Musical Times about this historic moment. While playing over the chorus in G, so that's the chorus from the Mendelssohn Festgesang, he was at once struck by its adaptability to the words Hark the Herald Angels Sing. He copied out the parts and the tune was sung with great enthusiasm by the congregation at Waltham Abbey.
In this very church?
In this church, on Christmas Day.
Oh, it's just perfect.
Hark the Herald was too good to resist. In 1861, the Church of England published it in Hymns Ancient and Modern. The floodgates had opened to Christmas carols with words which weren't from the Bible. The magical blend of pagan and religious words and music were now welcomed into church.
Actually, there's a wonderful anarchy to Christmas carols. These are sort of grassroots musical gestures. They're written in the fields and the streets and the pubs, and they're brought into the church. The words were actually written 100 years earlier, and the music only came along in a different country, a different century, to be brought together by a third man. Is a wonderful illustration, I suppose, of the chants involved in the best carols.
They're like mongrels of music, are they? There's something quite fresh and zingy and exciting about them.
Yeah, this is not music that we've been forced to sing. This is music that we wanted to sing so badly that the church was forced to bring it inside, to put its own stamp on it.
To let us sing it, in fact.
Absolutely.
The newborn.
An image depicting a royal family gathered around a Christmas tree adorned with colourful decorations.
In the 19th century, Queen Victoria and her beloved Albert helped create a new image of Christmas as a time for family, home and hearth. They also inspired the fashion for Christmas trees.
A star on a tree, then a crescent moon in the night sky.
And a world-famous Christmas carol started out as a simple little poem in a magazine.
In the bleak midwinter.
In 1871, the editor of a New York magazine asked an English poet in London to write a poem for Christmas. Her name was Christina Rossetti. She wanted to write something really special, but she was seriously ill.
She was in a bad way. She'd previously suffered from what we might call depression, and now she had a really horrible thyroid problem. She kept fainting and having headaches. Her brother said that she was in a deplorable condition. But even so, she really wanted to fulfill this request, and she sent to Scribner's magazine a little poem. They paid her £10 for it. She called her work A Christmas Carol, and you probably know how it goes.
Emmanuel Yembe, Ely Cathedral Choir.
But Rossetti's poem wasn't ready to be transformed into this beautiful Christmas carol just yet.
Perhaps it was a bit out of step with the whole idea of Victorian Christmas, as recently reinvented by Charles Dickens. That was much more about festive family fun. Maybe Rossetti's work was too reflective to become really popular.
Dr. Dinah Rowe, Oxford Brookes University.
What kind of a person would you say Rossetti was?
I would say Rossetti's a very wintry person. She had a very cold, very reserved exterior.
Was she born that way, or did life deal her a tough hand?
I think probably both. She had some sad events in her life. I think she's the sort of person who thought very deeply about life and the human condition. And anyone who thinks deeply about the human condition on a daily basis is bound to wind up, a bit melancholy.
Can you explain some of the techniques that she uses to build the very special atmosphere of the poem?
Well, she uses monosyllabic words, moan and stone, and then snow, and this creates a sense of monotony and fallenness.
And the snow, it does fall on snow, doesn't it?
It gives you a sense of that cumulative effect of kind of mournfulness and sadness, although there is a kind of a predictor of something happier happening, because unlike stone, snow is something a bit softer. Now imagine a kind of glitter effect. It's a bit of magic is about to happen.
Do you think that she thought it might end up being sung? She calls it a carol, as if it was supposed to be sung.
I imagine that she hoped it would become a carol. She always wanted to write an important English hymn.
What can I give him?
Christina Rossetti never got to see her poem become the carol we know today.
If we were
she died on the 29th of December, 1894. In 1906, a young composer called Gustav Holst wrote this melody for it. Another composer, Harold Dark, wrote a different tune, and this is the one that's often the favourite of musicians.
In the bleak midwinter, from
There's something very female about this carol to me. Is that fair?
I think there absolutely is something female about this carol, and that's very deliberate on Rossetti's part. I think the most important word in this poem is enough. She writes, enough for him, a breast full of milk and a manger full of hay. Actually, it's enough for him to have a very warming breast full of milk. And this is where the carol starts to melt. So while that frostiness warms up with the mother's heart, I asked my students, what do you think is the perennial appeal of this carol? And one of them just looked at me and told me, I can't really explain why this poem appeals to me so much, but I thought, well, you have explained because you've just touched your heart and you've shown us the appeal of Christina Rossetti in that she appeals to our hearts.
I don't think that Rossetti's carol has got into the Christmas canon despite its melancholy. I think it's got in because of its melancholy. There is something bittersweet about Christmas, isn't there? It makes you think of the people that you used to celebrate it with who aren't around anymore. The heroine of this carol is definitely the mother. So if it means anything today, it's surely phone your mum.
Horses on a misty hillside. O little town of Bethlehem. Lucy walking through a meadow, then a photograph of a priest in his long white robes.
In the 1860s, to escape the horrors of the American Civil War, a pastor called Phillips Brooks made a trip from Philadelphia to the Holy Land. When he reached the village where Jesus was born, he was inspired to write these words.
O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. The Reverend Phillips Brooks took his poem back to Philadelphia, where he got the organist of his church to write a tune for it. And it became a much-loved Christmas carol that's still sung to this day. At least in America, the story in Britain is quite a bit different.
Fields and woodlands stretching away towards the distant horizon.
In 1903, the English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams was setting out on a pilgrimage of his own. He grew up here in Surrey. He was passionate about the countryside, and he tried to capture it musically in pieces like The Lark Ascending.
And his other passion was English folk songs. He once said that they are beautiful and immortal.
They belong to us all, high and low, rich and poor. Sing what we like, and like what we sing. We, the singing English.
And in December 1903, he came from his house up there, and he went off down this hill on a mission to capture for posterity the very best English folk songs. Hello.
Hello there.
Can I get a lift with you?
Yes.
She climbs aboard a horse-drawn cart.
Oh, off we go.
They head off down a country lane.
In the village where Vaughan Williams lived, the meat was delivered by the local butcher in a cart. And the cart was often driven by the assistant butcher, who was a man called Frank Lawrence. Frank was a bit of a star of the local church choir. He had a really lovely deep bass voice. And he loved folk songs nearly as much as Vaughan Williams did. What's more, Frank knew where to find them. Hey, Dan, have you got a lovely deep bass voice?
Not really, no.
Lucy beams as they travel along a hedge-lined road. Then she's on foot, approaching a country pub called The Plough.
The butcher introduced Vaughan Williams to a man with a tune that would work perfectly in a new book of hymns.
On one of Vaughan Williams's trips around these Surrey villages that Christmas, he was introduced to another man who was full of songs. This one was called Mr. Garman.
Later, at a table by the fire.
Irene Shettle is a Surrey folk singer.
Your good health, Irene.
Thank you.
Cheers.
She's been investigating how Mr. Garman helped Williams to create one of our favourite carols.
What's this document you've got on the table here?
Well, that's actually the manuscript book, the page on which there is a song that was sung to Vaughan Williams by Henry Garman. He collected about five songs from Henry Garman on the day, and he sang this one, which is The Ploughboy's Dream.
How did it go?
I am the ploughboy stout and strong as ever drove a team. Now 3 years since I slept in bed, I had a dreadful dream. Now since the dream has done me good, I put it down in rhyme, that other boys might read and sing whenever they have time.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
And that is practically O Little Town of Bethlehem, isn't it?
It's virtually the same.
And how old was he?
73.
73, and he was still at work as a labourer.
Yes, obviously it was a bit of a hard life. Mm.
Did he live to see his song become an official Christmas carol?
Very sadly, no. He died almost exactly two years after it had been collected from him on Boxing Day in 1905. And Vaughan Williams co-edited the English hymnal with Percy Dearmer. It came out in 1906, and that's where his arrangement of O Little Town of Bethlehem first came out. I sometimes do wonder what he would have thought if he knew what had happened to his song, that we all sing that tune every year and know it so well. To know he'd given that to the rest of us is quite, for me, something, actually.
Let's have a little toast to Mr. Garman.
To Mr. Garman.
Thanks,
definitely.
Mr. Garman.
Yes, indeed.
Hope you're not working too hard in the fields of heaven.
Stalls at a Christmas market.
Christmas is seen as a time for eating and drinking and family. Whatever the reality of this might be in our homes, it's also supposed to be a time of peace.
Tall trees silhouetted against jagged, snow-dusted peaks under a clear blue sky.
But our final carol was born out of conflict and destruction, and it's perhaps the most beautiful of them all.
Stille Nacht, Silent Night. Lucy walks through a snow-covered landscape dotted with timber cabins.
In 1816, a young curate arrived at his first posting in a small village near Salzburg. Joseph Moore had lived through turbulent times. The Napoleonic Wars had torn Austria apart.
In 1816, just as Moore was beginning his first job, things settled down with the defeat of Napoleon. Now, these wars had completely devastated this part of Europe. 500,000 Austrians had died. And with this in mind, Moore was inspired to write a poem. His motivation comes out in the ending of the first verse. It concludes with the words, "Sleep in heavenly peace."
Dodo Mura, The Makemaids.
Heilige Nacht, alle schlief, einsam war, nur das Traum.
It was a simple, heartfelt response to the recent conflict, but it would become one of the most popular carols in the world.
Sunlight shimmering on a tree-lined river.
Joseph Moore went on to become the parish priest here in Oberndorf.
But he hadn't forgotten about his poem, and the story goes that on Christmas Eve 1818, Moore walked across town to find the local church organist, Mr. Gruber. He wanted to ask Gruber to write a tune to go with his words, but here's the challenging part. He wanted it done that day, so that they could perform it that night.
A whitewashed chapel.
This is the Silent Night Chapel. It was built to commemorate the first performance of the carol, which was accompanied by guitar at midnight mass.
What have you brought to show me?
This is the oldest written record of Silent Night.
Melody by
Franz Xaver Gruber.
Gruber.
And text from Joseph Moore in 1816. That says Christmas song.
Christmas song.
Weihnachtslied.
Is it true, this story of how the music for Silent Night was written in one afternoon?
We think that's exactly what happened. It is quite plausible because the song itself, it's not too complicated. The chord progression is quite simple.
What can you tell me about the first performance?
Well, according to the eyewitness, Mr. Gruber himself, he was the bass, and Joseph Moore, his friend, the priest, sang the top line of the song.
On Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve, 1818.
Why do you think that they chose the guitar? That's not an instrument that I associate with the church.
That's where the guitar actually comes in. It's a song for the people, from the people. It was an instrument that you would find in taverns and bars, and I think that's what made it connect to the people a lot, because the guitar was something that they knew from outside of the church.
Now, this song, Silent Night, has made this little town famous all over the whole world. Why do you think that the song works globally?
The simplicity is what translates into any language and into any culture, and that's what works with pop songs in general.
You would describe it as a pop song.
Exactly. I think it's in the top rank of the Christmas charts.
A stained glass window depicting a star and a guitarist.
Silent Night went around the world. It's been translated into more than 230 different languages. And its place in history was secured during the First World War. It happened in northern France on Christmas Eve, 1914.
By this time, the Germans and the British had dug themselves into their trenches, about a stone's throw apart. Some soldiers' families had sent them tiny little Christmas trees made out of pipe cleaners. They had these in the trenches, they lit candles, they'd done everything they could to make themselves feel a bit better. One man who was there in the trenches that night was called Albert Morin.
It was a Christmas card. Christmas Eve, there was a white, beautiful moonlight, frost on the ground, almost white everywhere. And round about, I think about 7 or 8 in the evening, we heard this singing, a lot of commotion, and we saw some lights. I don't know what they were, some lights. And later, we heard them singing, "Still a Silent Night, Still a Night, Silent Night." I shall never forget it. It's one of the highlights of my life, absolutely, to see them. I thought, what a beautiful tune.
And then Albert and the British soldiers sang back. It turned into an impromptu carol service.
Heute Knabe in Lockigen.
Across northern France and Belgium, it's been estimated that around 100,000 soldiers took part in this spontaneous Christmas truce. Some soldiers from both sides climbed out of the trenches and met up in the middle. They sang carols, some gave each other Christmas presents, things like tobacco, some even played football, while others took the opportunity to bury the bodies of their comrades who'd fallen in no man's land. Of course, the truce didn't last for long, but the carols had worked their magic. Just for a little while, they'd brought comfort and comradeship and a little bit of peace. Have been with us for as long as we've celebrated Christmas. So it's not surprising that the story of the carol turns out to be a history of Christmas itself. And that's because they are the people's music. They're genuinely pop music in the sense that they're popular of the people. And they constantly change as society changes. Most of all, though, they reflect a really ancient need that people have always felt to celebrate together and to sing together at Christmas.
Sherlock, Lucy Worsley is on the case of Conan Doyle to discover why the writer wanted to kill off the detective that had brought him fame and fortune. Watch now on BBC iPlayer.